from Nebraska to South Carolina, Massachusetts to Nevada, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, partnering with China on climate change will further erode America's energy independence and harm the U.S. economy. We explore the issue with Jason Isaac of the American Energy Institute. Mike Johnson has been Speaker of the United States House of Representatives for a bit over a week. We'll get the real story from the Club for Growth, Scott Parkinson, on how the first week went. A new poll found 87% of Americans want Congress to do something to ensure the financial stability of Social Security. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine gets details from Patrick Hedger of the Taxpayer Protection Alliance. And Hamas was elected to govern Palestinians, and the consequences have turned tragic. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College has this week's American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. The United States partnering with China to deal with so-called climate change will compromise both our nation's energy independence and our economy. To learn more, we talk with Jason Isaac. He is founder and CEO of the American Energy Institute. Jason, welcome to American Radio Journal. Jason, President Biden in recent weeks has been before the United Nations, and of course, he talked up the issue of climate change, so-called man-made climate change, wants to work with China, of all countries, on that. When you look at the Chinese and some other nations, are they really likely effective partners to work with relative to reducing CO2 emissions?
Well, they're working with us, and that's because they're working against us at every aspect and every turn. China will talk a great talk about their efforts to decarbonize, but they have no intentions of doing so and really don't need to, in my opinion. I've run the numbers, and if you look at the UN models to decarbonize, it doesn't do anything to mitigate a changing climate. It doesn't do anything to stop the planet from warming, if it is warming, and there are some data that show over the last 8 years it's not warming. But what it does do is it does increase the cost of everything. When you get American energy producers and when you get to globalists focused on reducing CO2 emissions, that's where the Chinese have realized, ha, we've got them. And now we can continue with our Belt and Road initiative to build more infrastructure. And that's exactly what they're doing. They add a coal-fired power plant every single week, something that we really need to be doing in this country. I've testified multiple times in front of the U.S. Congress, and I joke, sort of joke, that say of all the technology the Chinese steal from us, it'd be nice they would utilize our pollution control technology. They don't. They could care less about the environment or human rights, but we use coal in this country more responsibly than anywhere else on the planet, and we actually need to be using a lot more of it to provide affordable, reliable energy.
Is the United Nations, Jason, really an effective forum to have this discussion?
No, they're really not. I am a huge proponent of the U.S. getting out of the United Nations. Just in the last couple of days, Senator Mike Lee, I think, has called for the same. The Dutch foreign minister has called for people to get out of and countries to get out of the United Nations. They've just really become kind of a sounding piece for Antonio Gutierrez, who is really just this alarmist crybaby, if you will, constantly screaming and crying about climate change and quite honestly scaring people with misinformation that just couldn't be further from the truth. We're living wonderfully well over the last 100 years through this man-made industrial revolution that people think is the only thing that's changing the climate, which again, that couldn't be further from the truth. We've seen a 99% reduction in deaths from severe weather-related events over the last 100 years, and that's while our population has quadrupled on this planet. We're feeding more people. Access to affordable, reliable energy is the key to ending poverty, and people like Antonio Gutierrez at the UN and Klaus Schwab at the World Economic Forum, all they want to do is they want to control every aspect of our lives and make energy more expensive. And unfortunately, countries that are involved in the UN, namely the EU, they're embracing these policies that do that. And it's all under the guise of net zero and decarbonization, which again, doesn't do anything to mitigate a changing climate. I call decarbonization dangerous, deadly, and dumb.
Even looking back over the last 10, 15, 20 years here, Jason, and you look at the United States and the reduction that we've had in carbon emissions, have we not already made significant progress?
Yeah, we really have, and that's what happens if you're concerned about carbon emissions. Again, I'm not. CO2 is necessary for life on Earth. It makes up 0.04% of our atmosphere. If you eliminate all of it in the United States by 2050, the temperature differential by 2100 is less than 0.1 degree. There's no impact. And again, that's using the UN models. But where we have been leaders, if we are environmental leaders in the world, we've reduced pollution. The 6 criteria pollutants that the EPA tracks that some people claim in really high concentrations are harmful to human health. A lot of things in high concentrations, water, oxygen, are harmful to human health. But those 6 criteria pollutants, we've reduced those nearly 80%. Over the last 5 decades, we've become world leaders in clean air. In fact, during the first 2 months of the COVID lockdowns, when there were 50% fewer vehicles on the road, some cities in the U.S., Austin, Texas is an example, the air quality got worse. So when you take all these vehicles off the road, it doesn't do anything to improve air quality in the U.S. There are advocates say we need to go 100% electric. That doesn't do anything to improve the air quality. We've already got our air to practically near a natural state, and it's our trading partners, India and China, that saw significant improvements in air quality during the first 2 months of the COVID lockdowns because they just don't use the technology that we do. And during those last 50 years, we've also become number one at access to clean and safe drinking water, something that millions of people, really about 3.5 billion people on the face of the earth, have no access to that clean drinking water, which could be answered with access to energy. And as I tell people here in the United States, we stand over the key to ending that poverty. And that key is the energy that we produce, whether it be oil, gas, coal, or nuclear electricity. And we need to be producing more of it and getting it around the world to our friends and lifting the world's poor out of poverty.
Speaking of electricity, what are we doing here, Jason, as we're seeing some portion of our vehicle fleet being switched over to electric vehicles? That, of course, increases electricity demand. Are we also building new power plants, be they coal-fired, natural gas-fired, or if the electricity is being produced in another way, nuclear, wind, solar? Are we actually increasing the inputs into the electric grid?
No, unfortunately, we are not. We are not adding reliable, affordable generation that is thermal generation. That's where you heat water to spin turbines, and you do that with coal, you do it with natural gas, you do it with nuclear. It's just not happening. We are not adding new reliable thermal generation to our grid. What we are adding, and this is a policy area I've worked on over the last 2 decades, this is the biggest threat to our country. We've seen it happen firsthand in Germany. They went on this, and the German word translates to energy turnaround. They embraced it last decade. And now they're actually turning around their energy turnaround because all that they've experienced, no cleaner air, no cleaner water, but what they have experienced is a lot less industry. They've deindustrialized, they've shifted production.
We have been talking with Jason Isaac, who is the founder and chief executive officer of the American Energy Institute. Jason, tell us a bit about American Energy Institute. Also, what's your website?
Sure. The website's AmericanEnergyInstitute.com. We are a 501c3 charitable organization in the process of building a trade organization that represents American energy producers that is free market. We want free market. We want to get rid of the market-distorting policies that have come out of D.C. and out of the states. Our mission statement is really short: liberate America's energy, and we need to do that to lift the world's poor out of poverty.
Jason Isaac of the American Energy Institute. Jason, thank you for being with us.
Great to be on. Thanks for having me.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. We have a new speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives. He's finished about a week or so in office, so we're going to check in and see how he's doing. Scott, good to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Loman.
Well, Mike Johnson, a week or so under his belt. How is the new speaker faring?
Listen, I think it's refreshing to have new leadership in the House of Representatives. There's a lot of goodwill right now in the House to try to get some of these tight bills passed. And Mike Johnson has done a good job of showing his message to the American people with some big national interviews on Sean Hannity and elsewhere. And obviously, he's got a real challenge in getting to know the other side of Capitol Hill and the United States Senate. This week, Speaker Johnson went over to the Senate and had lunch with all the senators. And as you can imagine, some of them are sort of used to politics as usual, and they didn't really like his approach as it pertains to Israel and the IRS, or, you know, what his plans are with Ukraine and the continuing resolution on November 17th. But I think that there are many senators that say, you know what, uniparty, we've got to give this guy a chance to lead. He's in the majority in the House of Representatives. We're in the Senate minority. Let's try to back him up as much as we can and put Republicans in a position where we can actually win against the Biden administration over the next few weeks as these big fights get underway.
It's interesting here, Scott. You have Democrats who are opposing Mike Johnson and wanting to do just a clean bill on Israel. They always seem to want to combine various items, be it aid to Israel, aid to Ukraine, money for, quote, border security, and we can talk about that separately. This approach of doing things in a manner where you have one issue at a time, has that ever actually been tried before?
Well, this was part of the Speaker's fight back in January with Kevin McCarthy, right? We wanted to have single-issue bills brought before the House of Representatives, and I think that mostly that's been carried out in good faith, but obviously things get combined in terms of political expediency, and it's no different in the Senate with the way that these appropriation requests come in from the Biden administration. You got to keep in mind that the Biden supplemental appropriations request included about $100 billion. You got like $60 billion for Ukraine. You've got about $14 billion for Israel. You've got money for the southern border, which really means money to process asylum cases. It's not to strengthen and fortify the Border Patrol and their efforts, right? It's just to help bring in these open border illegal aliens. And then the other thing I would add is that the Biden request actually included money for Palestinians in Gaza as well. And so we don't know exactly how that money would be carried out, whether or not Hamas would take it over. And so I think there's a lot of questions for how Bibi Netanyahu is going to ask the United States for aid. And we need to ensure that it doesn't fall into the hands of Hamas and any other terrorist organizations.
Another area of concern at the moment is the very rapidly approaching, about 2 weeks away, deadline again for getting some sort of budget or spending authorization passed here, Scott. Is any progress being made toward that goal?
I think that that's part of what Mike Johnson, our new speaker, is working on, right? He is working forward on a path that can unify the Republicans on a continuing resolution. I think ultimately, if you're looking at aid to Israel to ride on a CR, or if you're looking at aid for Ukraine to ride on the CR, there need to be Republican concessions in place that actually give us a win and a way to sell whatever they're doing to the American people. I think there's a lot of folks that they are skeptical of giving the Ukrainians tens of billions of dollars more. $60 billion is a massive request that would effectively fund the Ukrainian operation for another year, and it takes off the table any transparency. It takes off the table any direction from the presidential nominee next year as well. And so I think that there's skepticism, there's deep skepticism of the American people, of the grassroots, in how to deal with Ukraine right now. But that'll come to the forefront here by November 17th. The next 2 weeks are going to be critically important to helping wrap up the work of the United States Senate and the House of Representatives as we conclude these big ticket items in the end of the year. There's also a big farm bill reauthorization that's outstanding. So I'm interested to see how the negotiating posture of this new Republican conference led by Speaker Mike Johnson, how they can put points on the board and get wins for the American people that limit the size, scope, and cost of the federal government, that limit the United States' ability to get drawn into another forever war, and also that our smart approach when it comes to rolling back some of this excessive Biden agenda that's been really jammed down the throats of the American people for the last 2.5 years.
All these tens of billions of dollars that are being proposed to go to Ukraine and Israel, Scott, is there any companion talk about there being transparency and accountability for how all that money is spent?
I think that there's Republicans that want to break this down into smaller amounts because then you will have accountability and transparency. It wouldn't just be a blank check. You know, I think that there's people that are incredibly sympathetic to the plight that the Ukrainians are facing in the war against Russia. And the Russians were the aggressors. But It doesn't mean that we can just continue to fund another country that's not even a part of our NATO alliance. And ultimately, when we've got our own issues here in America, I think there's an America First agenda that is spearheaded by the likely nominee in the Republican Party. And how all that is adjudicated over the next couple of months while Joe Biden is in office, I think is going to be interesting. I don't even know who the top negotiator right now would be for the Democrats. They never send Kamala Harris to negotiate with Congress. They never send Joe Biden. And so there's really this lack of leadership, which I think gives Speaker Mike Johnson a real chance to win when it comes to November 17th, when it comes to preventing an omnibus appropriations over Christmas, and when it comes to actually securing our southern border and preventing the onslaught of illegal immigrants pouring into our communities and destroying our chance at public safety.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth, keeping track of all of these issues that are before Congress. Many, many issues, much, much money. Scott, tell us a bit about the Club for Growth.
Club for Growth is based out of Washington, D.C., and we're united in the ideas of economic liberty, freedom, and opportunity. Check us out at clubforgrowth.org. In fact, you can sign up today as a member for free.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, we'll check in with you next week. Thank you.
Thank you.
The Social Security system is headed for insolvency, and a new poll finds Americans want Congress to do something about it before it is too late. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine discusses the issue with Patrick Hedger of the Taxpayer Protection Alliance.
Entitlement reform has long kind of been considered a third rail in American politics, you know, the thing that nobody wants to touch. But with the insolvency of Social Security and Medicare creeping closer, that perception might need to change. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Patrick Hedger. He is the executive director of the Taxpayers Protection Alliance, and that group has just put out a new poll this week that I think challenges some of those assumptions about some of these political assumptions about entitlement reform in Washington. He joins us now on the phone to talk about it. Patrick, thanks for taking some time with us.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with kind of the big picture here, Patrick. I mean, as I said, this is like a third rail issue in American politics. Nobody really wants to talk about this looming insolvency of the two big entitlement programs. But it seems like maybe voters have a more serious view of this than many politicians do.
Yeah, absolutely. I, frankly, was a little shocked by how overwhelming the responses were in our poll, right? We construct polls at TPA to tell us information, not tell us what we want to hear. But regardless, this poll showed us that overwhelming majorities, we're talking, depending on the question, in the 80s and 90% of voters saying they want to be leveled with on what to do about Social Security and Medicare. And when you level with voters, when you give them the straight talk that so many politicians promise but fail to deliver on, that they understand that these programs aren't sustainable. And they understand that the rhetoric about, oh, this person is talking about cutting your Social Security or Medicare benefits, I think the average voter does understand that if nothing happens, if we allow current law to proceed as it's written, these programs, they'll cut themselves, and they could bring down big chunks of the economy with them.
I think the most striking number to me was 5% in this poll. That was the number of respondents that said, oh, it's fine, you know, we don't have to do anything about these programs. Because that's the thing you hear from, like, I mean, President Joe Biden back during the State of the Union, right, got into it with Republicans where he was accusing them of trying to cut Social Security, and they're standing up saying, no, we're not going to do that. But you hear the same thing from, like, former President Trump talks a lot about, like, trying to demagogue against Democrats or D.C. elites or whatever, trying to change Social Security. You hear so much of this from politicians on both sides trying to accuse the other side of changing things. But there's actually like such a slim majority of voters that seem to hold that opinion.
Yeah, you're absolutely right about that. And I think this really challenges what anybody has heard in a political science degree, that you can't talk about entitlements. Why? Because the people that benefit from entitlements are predominantly older Americans, and older Americans vote at a higher propensity than anybody else. This poll has completely changed that perception, at least for me, and I hope it does for others as well. That's the goal of it. You can talk about these things. You should be leveling with the American people because, again, if nothing is done, those cuts are coming, and that'll be a bipartisan problem, or Congress will be faced with having to inject a massive amount of cash to save these programs. And look, we're not talking like this is the early 2000s when interest rates were at, you know, near historic lows, and we're not talking about a time when 2030 is way too far over the horizon to even be thinking about this. The next Congress and the next administration, if Joe Biden is reelected or somebody else gets elected, will have to deal with this problem. There's just no way around it. It's here, it's now, and we've got to be talking about how we're going to stave off some kind of catastrophe, whether that's a dramatic overnight cut in benefits or a massive cash infusion from the federal government to save these programs. And that cash infusion is going to be new debt, and that new debt is going to be issued at historic interest rates.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like it's still far away to me. Like 2030 sounds like it should be so far off in the future. I think that's a great way to think about it, though. I mean, let's say a Republican wins in 2024, and let's say it's a Republican who's eligible to run for reelection. I mean, by the time you get to the end of that potential next 8-year presidential term, you've come right up against it. Like, that's how far away we are, basically, at this point. We are 2 presidential terms away from the insolvency date, which is estimated to be somewhere around 2033 or so for Social Security, Medicare even sooner than that. These are obviously things that we have to be talking about, and we are talking about here. We're talking with Patrick Hedger, who is the executive director of the Taxpayers Protection Alliance, about this new poll that TPA has done looking at some of these, you know, I think challenging some of these notions about entitlement reform in D.C. Patrick, not a lot of time left here, but I want to get into just briefly, if we can, some of the solutions that you guys looked at. And in particular, one of the things that that you presented your respondents in the poll with was some of these ideas about, like, maybe changing the way benefits are structured, cutting other government programs. Like, tell us a little bit about that direction.
We put up a lot of different solutions against each other so folks could kind of rank what they think is probably the most feasible, would impact them the least. And we still found, like, wide support for a number of different potential solutions. You know, one of the most popular ones was means testing these programs, making sure billionaires aren't collecting Social Security and Medicare, folks that truly don't need these things that could save quite a bit of money. Raising the retirement age wasn't quite as popular, but still enjoyed, you know, in the 30s to 40% support. So there's a couple of different avenues that we pulled here. But what we consistently found is that folks, there was a wide base of support for really any number of actions to try and save these programs. And saving these programs doesn't mean continuing with the status quo and infusing new cash. You can improve these programs with market-based reforms. Privatizing certain aspects of these programs can reduce the cost but increase the quality of the product that the beneficiaries are getting. So the idea that we need to restructure these programs and make them less of a benefit is not necessarily the case.
Yeah, I think a lot of the stress around these issues comes from the uncertainty of it, right? And people feel like they just can't trust that it's there. And in some ways, if you privatize some of these things, you really actually give people maybe more security in knowing that their retirement savings are there and they don't have to trust, like, the politicians to deliver on these promises. Obviously, the first step to getting to those solutions, getting to any agreement about what that future might look like, is just talking about it. And hey, you can do that. We can talk about entitlement reform. It shouldn't be this scary thing that nobody can touch until it blows up in our face. That is unfortunately all the time we have for today, though. Patrick, thanks so much for taking some time with us.
Thank you for having me.
And once again, that is Patrick Hedger. He is the executive director of the Taxpayers Protection Alliance. You can check out their work online at protectingtaxpayers.org. Check out our coverage of this poll and everything else going on in Washington and around the country this week at Reason.com. And for Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Catch me next week right here on another edition of American Radio Journal.
The people of the Gaza Strip elected Hamas to run their territory and are now suffering tragic consequences. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College gives us a history lesson on this American Radio Journal commentary.
Over the last few weeks, the Palestinian people of the Gaza Strip have been under siege. One feels for the Gazans. They're suffering serious deprivation, lacking basic supplies and food and water, watching their homes and hospitals and neighborhoods get leveled, and are being held as human shields, blocked from fleeing the country. All of this ugliness unraveled with Hamas's attack on Israel on Saturday morning, October 7, 2023. What has erupted since that awful morning was detonated not by Israel, but by Hamas. So, having expressed my sincere sympathy for what the people of Gaza are going through, I must bear this bad news, which isn't news to anyone knowledgeable of the history and politics of the region. Namely, these Palestinians have gotten who they voted for. Sure, Gazans didn't vote for this hell, but they did vote for Hamas. And this is what Hamas is. I will not here in this commentary give a deep dive into the history and politics of the modern Palestinian state, or lack thereof, But here are a few salient details that might be helpful for you all to know. On November 29, 1947, the United Nations established two states in the territory of Palestine, the new nation state of Israel and a Palestinian state comprised of the Gaza Strip and the West Bank. For decades thereafter, what ruled Gaza and the West Bank was chaos. By the late 1990s, after surprising historic peace agreements signed between Israel and the PLO's Yasser Arafat, a Palestinian state finally began to emerge, with Arafat's so-called Palestinian Authority as the governing body. Those peace accords, frankly, were the best thing that Arafat ever did. But even then, he was a problem. Arafat needed to go. Well, with Arafat's long-awaited death in November 2004, Palestinians, just 2 months later, in January 2005, finally held an election for a president, and they elected Mahmoud Abbas, for better or worse. He was now president of the governing Palestinian Authority and the successor to Yasser Arafat. So Mahmoud Abbas became the leader of the Palestinian state. All right, I know this is a lot of names, but bear with me. Then, a year later, in January 2006, something crazy happened. The Palestinian Arabs in the Gaza Strip elected Hamas to a majority of seats in the governing legislature. And that is to say that the people democratically elected an organization long and widely considered to be a terrorist group committed in its charter to the destruction of Israel. Hamas had exploded onto the scene literally about 30 years ago with an April 1993 suicide bombing protesting Yasser Arafat negotiating peace with the Israeli leadership. The world was shocked when the Palestinians of the Gaza Strip in January 2006 democratically elected Hamas, again, a terrorist organization, to govern them. We were told at the time by Western experts that when Gazans elected Hamas, well, it wasn't because they wanted terrorists committed to invading Israel and taking hostages. No, 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 we were told. Gazans elected Hamas because its political candidates did a bang-up job of quote-unquote campaigning, promising better social services. They were better at going door-to-door, selling themselves like politicians do, handshaking, backslabbing, handing out lollipops to the kiddies, kissing babies. In fact, I could hear on air read emails from colleagues of mine at the time telling me, calm down, you got to understand that Hamas simply did a swell job campaigning. This wasn't a choice for terrorism by the good folks, the voters in Gaza. Well, maybe not. But their choice led to terrorism. Why? Because they elected terrorists. The smiling political candidate of Hamas put aside a hand grenade for the Jews while he handed the Muslim granddad a cigar. But behind that smile, he was still a terrorist, ready at any moment to light a fuse with a cigar. And so, here we are now. The Palestinians of Gaza are captive to the terrorists who they voted for in 2006. And they are under siege. Their country is being ripped apart, and many are dying. The lesson, be careful who you vote for. For American Radio Journal, I'm Paul Kengor. Thanks for listening.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including our newest affiliate, KCBJ-FM in Jamestown, North Dakota. Welcome to our new listeners in the Peace Garden State. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.